Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me as usual is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up with our most recent episodes. Last week we talked about Parasite, and before that we talked about Uncut Gems. You can also keep an eye out for a book I'll be releasing called Content About Content. It'll be out in a couple weeks. I'll tweet that as well. And that's it. All right, James.
Yes.
Here we are, talking about another 2019 film. Three in a row.
Another Academy Award nominated film.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it won a single award, though, right?
Nope. So it's nominated.
Yeah. And also, it's crazy that Todd Phillips got nominated over Greta Gerwig. I just need to point that out very, very off the top.
Yeah, you could have made some money betting that a little while ago. But anyway. We are talking about Little Women, obviously. As you said, 2019 film directed by Greta Gerwig, based on a screenplay adapted from the novel by Louisa May Alcott.
Mm-hmm. Adapted also by Greta Gerwig.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Right.
A movie that, a book that we've seen adapted into a film a few times throughout the history of it. And I guess this was your choice to want to do this one, eh?
Yeah. I certainly suggested it. one of us had seen it about a week ago, you know, so it was me. I love this movie. I think it's incredible. And I don't know, I've spent obviously a lot of time thinking, like, is Little Women my favorite movie of the year, which was an absolute stacked movie year, and I think it might be. I don't know, I just think it's great, and I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's an incredible movie.
Yeah,
and nobody was more surprised by this than me. When I like saw Little Women for the first time, I was very surprised with how much I liked it, to the point where halfway through I was like, Is this my, like, a movie that I love? You know, because it just the makeup of it is not something that typically I would find myself gravitating towards.
Yeah. What do you mean the makeup of it?
Specifically, period piece tends right. not to be my favorite type of movie, and I feel like historically I'm not the biggest Greta Gerwig fan. I certainly as an actor, and like I liked Lady Bird fine, but I certainly not a classic in my eyes, like a lot of people saw it. And gotta eat a lot of crow. She's amazing.
Okay. Yeah. Because I remember asking you about this, and you had said that before I had seen it, you had said that it is definitely, you know, worth my time, and that they brought a lot more creativity to it, is the word that you used. And mm-hmm. I think that I'm just trying to think of what you said about what you're. What you're anticipating going into it, and I guess with an adaptation like this, you can kind of just get a straightforward retelling of the book, and that doesn't always leave a lot of room for creativity for a director. You know, there's mm-hmm. there's definitely ways to do it, no doubt, but it seems like if you do sort of a straightforward retelling, you lose a lot of the ability to have a lot of freedom and make a lot of big kind of creative choices, and there's still obviously a lot of work to be done in production design and costume design and, you know, acting and score and all these other things that comprise of a film. But just the fact that you had said the word creative just seemed like there was something more to this movie other than just a really good, you know, recreation of a story that we've kind of heard before.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we're getting at is, like, from afar, this movie, trailer, poster, all of it, cast as well. You've got Saoirse Ronan as the lead. Everything about it is just feels like one of those, like, just period piece Oscar-nominated sort of things that Kate Winslet would be in and we just wouldn't like. You know, like, it's just yeah. that we've seen 10 of these movies over the years, and, like, they always get nominated for awards, and then you and I are like, what are we doing here? And I think that's it. It's personal biases, basically, that have built up over history, a history of watching movies that look specifically designed to win awards. And also the other combination is, this is just a very famous book, and to be able to take a big swing with something like with a book this famous, you know, it's not like Peter Jackson couldn't change the Lord of the Rings books, you know, like those had to be faithful adaptations, because that's the way that you adapt books that are very famous and very popular. I haven't read Little Women. I haven't even done a lot of research about what has been changed from the movie. I can pretty comfortably guess. The fact that the thing that really put me over the top in this movie is just the idea of taking a big swing with a very famous piece of literature, and a famous piece of literature that has been adapted many times before in, to my understanding, more straightforward sort of ways, and just the confidence to be able to take a big swing and try and reframe how people perceive this book. Literature in general, and storytelling and performance and just all of these things. And I just think it's it happens all throughout the movie, and then just the conversation, the under the umbrella conversation, is really where it's just like drives everything home, you know.
Yeah we will do our best not to jump to
I think like again. The under the umbrella conversation is going to come up pretty early, because I think we have to talk about it early, and then we'll save the very ending. We'll save the 3 minutes that happens after that conversation. We'll save that for the end.
Right. Yeah. Because this is sort of, we'll say, bookended by a focus on Joe's writing. You know, we have a timeline that kind of jumps around a bit, but we first sort of get into this movie with her trying to sell her book or her friend's story to the publisher for the first time. And then essentially we get this entire story, and then we get back to her, that later timeline of her trying to sell essentially the story that we've just watched, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Like the beginning of this movie, like before we're introduced to the story of Little Women, we're introduced to the concept of storytelling as commerce, right? Like the first thing we see her trying to do is sell a story. She sells it for less than market value. She, after explicitly being told what market value is by the person buying the story.
Which is a funny joke.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Mr. Dashwood in general, played by the incomparable Tracy Letts, is always a blast. But, you know, and we get that close-up of when she hands her story over and money is exchanged. It's just this very, like, faux sort of insert shot. Like, that's just not how these things happen, you know? Like, it's just made to put, like, an exclamation point on that whole conversation. And when he's saying, yeah, we'll buy more of these, he says, Dashwood says, make it saucy or whatever. And that's sort of how Joe leaves that conversation feeling about her work. She's like, she's writing for money, and so she's going to write for what people can buy. And a big portion of this movie, this is one of the things that runs throughout, is Joe learning how to write a story that is good and people actually want to read, as opposed to listening to the person that's handing her money for it. And that's one of the ongoing conversations throughout this movie that I really enjoy. Frederick, the critic, is involved in it when he's critiquing her next story that she would write, and just tells her it's bad, essentially. And Joe blows up. But and Beth and Amy both point out the idea of, you know, sort of writing your story, you know. And I think a big part of Joe's learning curve throughout this movie is learning that, you know, to write her own story, and then somebody will potentially gravitate to it. You know, it's, you don't know that that people want to read these saucy stories, to quote Mr. Dashwood. You only know that Mr. Dashwood wants to buy them, and then you're sort of choosing, do I write a story that I care about, or do I write specifically as a job, you know?
Yeah, and
is there a way to do both, you know?
So. Yeah, and I that's what Frederick gets to when talks about Shakespeare being the greatest living poet, because he smuggles his poetry into popular entertainment or something like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is sort of emblematic of this movie, especially in the way that kind of has two endings at the same time, is that you tell the kind of more straightforward, maybe more crowd-pleasing story, but you also address the things that are important to you, and people will, some people might just take it on face value, and some people might care a bit more deeply about some of the other things that you're trying to tell and other ideas that you're trying to get across.
Yeah, and I think the key conversation where Joe really starts to turn a little bit. I mean, Beth is the first one of the sisters to mention to Joe when they're on the beach that she should write the stories that come to her, as opposed to a more targeted, like targeting an audience specifically. And then later, when this is after Beth has died, Amy and Meg and Joe are walking together, and they have the domestic struggles conversation. And Joe says writing doesn't confirm important. She doesn't think anybody would read about domestic struggles. And then she says writing doesn't confirm importance; it reflects it. Amy's response is, "I don't think so. Writing will make them more important." And I think that's a big moment in the. And then Joe says, "When did you get smart?" Basically, to Amy, I think that's a big moment in both in Joe and Amy's relationship in general, and also Joe realizing, like, to listen to Amy, basically. And that's pretty soon, or right before she starts writing what ends up becoming Little Women, And I think, I don't know, I think the underlying idea of commerce is a cool idea,
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's really central. And I think that your point about that insert shot of being just the most straightforward metaphor of, creative work for cash and art versus commerce in one visual representation is important. And just one more thing about the criticism of Joe's writing within this book or within this film is that when Frederick, is very blunt with her, with his criticism of her writing, and he's not rude about it. Or, I mean, maybe he could have been a bit nicer, but you can tell he's not deliberately trying to hurt anyone's feelings, and that all he's doing is taking her seriously as a writer. And he says, "You're talented. That's why I'm telling you this." There is definitely a way that he could just kind of be softer to her, and she would like him more in the short term, right? But just that she has this very kind of personal reaction. She takes this criticism as sort of an indictment of her character when really he is just trying to help out as someone who has probably read more and understands a bit more about this than her as someone of her age. And her response doesn't come off as very likable. It seems sort of petty, at least in my opinion, the way that she personally attacks him. And I think it's great. I think it's really good that they gave this character, sort of a moment of weakness and showed her that, she's still kind of growing as a person and growing as an artist, and she's not taking criticism very well at this point, but ends up growing up. And I think that's an important part about having a dynamic, rounded out character that's not just perfect all the time and representative of anybody who has creative pursuits like this. There's times where you do get criticism. There's times that you react poorly. And I just thought that this was a good way to do this, because I think that so many people gravitate towards Joe when they read the books and watch the movies, and you're meant to. I really think this is designed for you to kind of come away liking this character. But I thought it was a good way to not just kind of whitewash everything and just make her seem like a great person all the time, because she definitely does some great things throughout this. But I think one thing that makes her character dynamic is that she has some of that anger that Marmee talks about, and is just not is sort of rough around the edges, and that's one thing that people like about her. And I think that they did a good job of making her more realistic and having the reaction that she did.
Oh, absolutely. And she, Joe in general, I think I think that's sort of like a real, I think that's like a representation of basically what every writer goes through when they're criticized, but most people keep it inside of them. And Joe just sort of lets it all out. And like you're saying, I like that scene as well. I also love the conversation of when she says, "Nobody's gonna remember you when you're gone," to Frederick, and his response is, "Oh, I'm certain of it." Like, that's such a great. I love the depiction of, because if you put a critic in a movie, then you know, it's, you have to be kind of very careful about it, because you have to make sure that you don't come off, like, from Greta Gerwig and the filmmakers' perspectives, come off as somebody who's like talking shit about critics in general. And I think that the way Frederick is portrayed throughout this movie is just like the best portrayal of a critic, and that he's like, yeah, this is what I do. I'm willing to accept that it's not super important, but this is who I am, and this is my skill set, and I like that. And I also like the way that Joe interacts there. And going with what you're talking about with Joe's responses, and I think a moment where she sort of keeps it more internal is when at the very beginning, when she gives Dashwood her first story, the way that Dashwood is flipping the pages, well, before that, when she says she won a prize, and the way Dashwood repeats it, like, a prize, like, he just says it, he just makes a meal out of the word, and it's great. And she, you can see on Saoirse Ronan's face, like, she immediately feels dumb about mentioning the prize. She sort of feels like her whole strategy here hasn't she's rethinking it. She's doing it all internally, and then as she's sitting there watching him read the story, I just felt the thud that his hand makes every time he hits his desk when he flips a page. The editing there is kind of like slightly jump cuttier than most of this movie is, and I thought that was a really good representation of what it feels like to watch somebody read or consume something that you have created. And just before we move on from the storytelling as commerce, like, sort of staying along the lines of like that conversation about writing doesn't confirm importance, it reflects it, and Amy's comeback to Joe, the Mr. Dashwood doesn't change his mind, you know, like he changes his mind, but he doesn't decide to publish Little Women. He has to be talked into publishing Little Women by his children, right? And they find the chapters lying around the house, and ask, like, demand to have the rest of them. And that's how we get to a point where Joe is back in Dashwood's office reading, and he's reading the whole, as opposed to just a few chapters. And I thought that was a really interesting, again, depiction of the idea of capitalism having to change their idea of what a story is, and there's still a negotiation about what the actual ending is, but the majority of it is Joe's, and she has to make this one concession. And I thought that was a really interesting thing in general, but I also thought it was very interesting given everything that we've talked about to this point, because a conversation like that likely had to occur about making a major motion picture about a famous book, where it's like, yeah, we want to try something new and adventurous with it. There probably has to be some sort of convincing done for the person handing over the $40 million or whatever the budget of this movie was, you know. And I just thought that was an interesting, very subtle depiction of something that probably happened in a Sony boardroom somewhere.
Yeah, no, I think that that's, to me, that is sort of the most interesting part of this movie, is the way that it plays with that and that ending itself. So, no, I definitely think that that's true. And I think that I was reading other people talk about that this is a movie that really benefited from Greta Gerwig having made Lady Bird before this, and it being, you know, something she wrote and directed, and that was such a big hit. And I mean, definitely people were very aware of her before, but this really just elevated her, and that to make Little Women now after that, and being under the spotlight and being scrutinized because of, you know, her previous success, they at least read that as informing so much of that ending and really balancing out what to do with that spotlight now that she has it, and these ideas of what you want to tell in a story, you know, Lady Bird being, I guess, semi-autobiographical, you know, having things that are very important and very close to you, while at the same time accessible to other people. And then when you think about her taking somebody else's work, and I think it's particularly important that Little Women is seen as pretty autobiographical, or at least semi-autobiographical, of Alcott, to take a story that's so personal to somebody else and then inject some of your own ideas into it and some of your professional experiences is must be a tricky balance. And I think that sort of two parallel endings that we get to that is part of her sort of addressing those two things of her wanting to stay true to source material, but also wanting to not have to compromise in a way that Alcott mm-hmm. does, because I think that they've always sort of perceived that the ending of Little Women exists purely for these commercial reasons that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And now that it's, you know, 150 years later, and this person already had, or Greta Gerwig already had big success by the time she got to this point in her career, that she doesn't have to make those compromises, or at least only has to half compromise them, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I think this is better than just changing it. I think the playing with it is so much more interesting than just Frederick just goes away. You know, like I think the scene, so we're talking about the scene that happens in the middle of the conversation between Dashwood and Joe at the end, when they're talking about the under the umbrella, like why doesn't she get married, basically.
Yeah.
Just, oh, it's so good. That whole sequence, and you know, throughout the movie there are kind of hints that you know, that we'll get into later about, you know, maybe not everything is true to fact. Some of these things are being embellished by Joe, but that is where they really go over the top with it. And the, like, Frederick's performance is just nothing like his performance in the rest of the movie. Same with Saoirse Ronan, Florence Pugh, a little bit of the same thing. And I just thought it was really interesting the way that Dashwood pushes back about the ending of Joe, or Joe's equivalent, not ending up with a human being, like not getting married. And her immediate reaction is just like, yeah, sure, I'll change it. If this is what it takes, so be it. Like, it's, she doesn't even really push back on the compromise. She's like, if I can get all of these other things and change this one thing to be something that I don't necessarily love, or isn't necessarily in line with who I am, then so be it. You know, like I've won, I'm still winning the battle, basically. And I think that's really cool. And I think the fact that this movie is doing it with such a famous book, I think makes it almost sort of reframes the idea of basically every piece of classic literature. It's like, it makes me rethink, like, I suppose I don't read a ton of classic literature, but it sort of makes you think about what lies exist in other books simply to get them published, which is something we talk about a lot on this podcast with more recent movies, is, well, that probably exists purely for commerce and all of these things, but you never think about it as something like Little Women is more of a historical text to us than like a novel, you know, whereas, you know, the Jenny Awful book Weather is a new novel, you know, like we're not looking at that as a historical text, you know? And I just thought that was, it really made me like think about classic literature in general, and specifically all the stories that don't get to be told. I think that's one of the things that runs throughout Little Women, is that Joe and Alcott, it's like, this is a woman writing a story. She's one of very few women who were able to write stories, one of very few non-white men able to write and publish stories. And that's the real success, basically. And, or at this time, you know, and I think this ending, her changing that ending to get her book out there, really underlies the fact that there are so many stories that are untold and so many stories that are told with lies, that telling a story this big and this expansive with just one lie at the end, you know, it's kind of like, it's kind of great, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense, but that sort of, that all happened like in a 30-second span in my head when I saw this movie for the first time, and it became clear that what they were doing with Under the Umbrella was just like playing with history, playing with the story, and I don't know. I found it very moving. I loved it.
Yeah, and so you said that this was a very big and very expansive story, and
well, like it's small, but it's like covers a lot of time, and the book is famously like a pretty long book, you know?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to kind of separate out some of your ideas about what you're expecting from this book. Like when I think of a big, when you, you're sort of getting at, I don't think we use the term, but Oscar bait movies, which sometimes are, you know, the scope is big, they're very long, maybe a lot of timelines, or I mean a big timeline, a lot of characters. Did this feel as sort of expansive in scope, or does it feel like it's a smaller film in some ways, or how do you look at this in sort of that grand perspective?
I think the time shifting is the main thing that makes it feel really grand, because you almost get two movies in one, and they're in constant negotiation, like the jumps between the past and the present of this story are just like almost more frequent than, like, you probably remember them as pretty frequent, but they're more frequent than you remember. And the way that they connect is so intricate. And I wrote down every transition from the present to the past, just to look at and vice versa, just to see how they were done and how they link together. And the connections are just like airtight. This screenplay is incredible. You know, like, this isn't something that was figured out in editing. It was something that was decided before the film was, you know, it's like Soderbergh's my guy. He figures out things in editing. The Limey is a movie pieced together in editing after they realized the script didn't work, right? This is not that. This is a script that was made to the script, and the script is airtight. And it's just, I think that constant negotiation, because, for somebody like me, I always sort of approach something that takes place in the past that's also about a writer. I always take the everything that happens in the past, I take with sort of like a dash of memory, sort of like reframing everything, you know, like I don't view anything that happens in the 7 years earlier sort of portion of this movie as 100% accurate, you know, whereas I view that more as Joe's reflection of the past,
right?
Then whereas with the present, it just feels more you know, like it's a colder, more realistic sort of look at the world. And yeah, and I just think it's just the time shifting. The time shifting is the thing that runs through the whole movie and is done so well that it makes the story more grand, because it makes the story take place over 8 years as opposed to just these two small stories taking place over shorter periods of time, right?
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, no, I think the time, the different timelines have a few functions, because I think one of them is it just does feel more modern. I don't think that this movie is necessarily, you know, a failure by any means if it tells it in a very straightforward fashion, but I think it is engaging, and I think that maybe people who have seen other adaptations of this or you know, read it a lot, and I'm not one of those people, but I think that this would probably give it a bit of a shot in the arm to be something newer. You know, you probably watch it because you want to see a new take on it, and I think that just the knowledge that it does that is at least gives you sort of a bit of novelty to it, and I don't mean it in a gimmicky way, but just something to something new to appreciate about it. And I think that it also, because we meet Jo when she's a bit older, and because she is further along in her writing career, and her struggles seem to be kind of more adult struggles, I think it's a bit more accessible for adults, because I think sometimes you worry when writing about teenagers that if the people viewing it aren't still teenagers, some of their struggles seem a bit less important and a bit more petty. Mm-hmm. And I think that meeting her when we do, and I mean, I'm just closer to her age in the second, you know, the further along timeline than the initial one. So maybe that's why I'm saying that it's more easy to relate to, but it just seems like teen movies and things like that can have a bit more of a shelf life. I'm probably talking to the wrong person about that.
But, no, I've in the last few years, my enjoyment of teen movies has very much fallen off. So
yeah, okay,
yeah.
But
everybody ages.
Yeah, no. But then you know, we meet her as an adult, so I think it's easier to kind of jump back in because you're already sort of invested in her and know what sort of where she's heading. I think that it's a bit more accessible for an adult. But I did, can you take me through like one or two of these transitions, because I don't want to just kind of go through the whole plot with this mind frame, but the, you know, maybe one or two times that it jumps between the present and the past, or past and present, and maybe some, you know, emotional sinew that connects the two, or some reason that you think that not telling it in a purely linear fashion is the most rewarding way, just because, you know, your brain typically functions in a straight line. I just want to see what we get from the way that this movie jumps around, because I see a lot of people saying it and saying that, as you said, it's not just found in the editing, that there are these certain emotional beats that are important, and it's, you know, pretty brilliant the way that they string them together in the fashion that they do. So I don't know if you have one on hand that you can kind of provide to.
Well, I don't know if I've made it clear yet in this podcast, but my notes for this movie are very extensive. So I'm trying to find, like, I eliminated the transition notes from my pared down version of the notes for the podcast, because then I was like, this podcast would be 3 hours long. But the two that, okay. Like, the things that have jumped to mind as you're mentioning them is, one, we go from Beth's funeral. When you remember that shot where the four people, it's Joe, Marmy and their dad, and then Hannah, the servant or helper, whatever her role in the family is, they're all standing, and then all three other than Joe clear out, and Joe is just standing there looking at Beth's graves. And then we get a cut to her looking out the window in the past, and it's Meg's wedding day, and she's staring at Beth as Beth is like getting some flowers ready on the around the March's residence where the wedding's being held. And that's something that's like, that's a pretty obvious one, right? Like, it's her thinking about her own sister and then jumping back into a past where her sister was still alive. And the other one I remember is earlier in the film, when she's first going home, Joe's first going home, she's on the train and she falls asleep. And we get sort of this push in to her face as she's asleep. And that's when we get our flashback to the first Christmas morning, which is only the second time we've been in the past, I think, at this point. And it's like, there's a real shift in the style of the movie there. It sort of feels like, temporarily feels like it was very Aaron Sorkin inspired, just the way that the girls interact with each other, like they're talking over each other all the time, and it's just much more energetic than most of the present. And that whole sequence is just like, it feels like one of the warmest memories of somebody's childhood, right? And yeah. Then the person working on the train ends up waking her up, and she's the last person on the train. That's what brings her back to the present, is her being reminded of the reality of the situation. Like, you're in Concord now, and get off the train and go see Beth, you know? So those are the two that jump to mind without searching through 8 pages of notes.
Okay. No, that's good. That's what I wanted.
Yeah. And also, like, I think the thing that the time shifting just in general is as sort of, because I feel like we're like a few years away from time shifting being seen as like a crutch. You know, I think we're almost at the point where everybody can sort of accept it. And I think that, or without it being like a cool thing to do, you know, like we're people who came of movie going age in the you know, late 90s, early 2000s, where time shifting is all the rage. You, like, felt like every movie in 1999 started at the ending and then worked its way jumped back and worked its way back to the end. But this is sort of, I don't know, it just feels like these things are in constant conversation. And I remember the thing that a movie like Memento, which is just entirely, it's like a sort of a, I don't, gimmick is a negative word to use for a movie that good, just like it is for Little Women. But like the memory every scene happening, you know, the movie happening in reverse order basically really throws you off from timing in the movie. Like, you can walk into that, if that movie's just on and you see a scene, you can't really piece together at, like, if you're at the 1 hour and 5 minute mark, it just sort of, you kind of get lost in time in general, just because the movie is constantly moving you from time to time. And I found that to be very similar with Little Women, as a movie I've now seen 4 times. And the last time I was taking all my notes and just checking times when things happen, and I was like, I never would have guessed this is 20 minutes in, or the under the umbrella conversation happens 5 minutes before the credits, you know? And I just, all these things, you're just, you just get lost in it. And I think the time shifting really helps you get lost. And the whole idea is all of these ideas coming together in Joe's head into something that she repurposes as a book, retelling her story. And I think the movie does a good job of conveying not just what happens in the book, but what happens in Joe's head to make these things come out as that book. You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's the main thing that time shifting adds. It almost makes it, it makes it feel more like watching the movie makes you more involved. It makes you feel like it's a human experience as opposed to a passive one where you're just sort of like just watching a story play out linearly in front of you, you know?
Yeah, and just I think to kind of line you up a bit with her, with Joe as a creative person, you know, living her life in a straightforward fashion, but also writing this book, which obviously would involve going back and reflecting on all these things and wondering how to piece them all together. And, you know, even if she was telling a pretty, you know, truthful representation of her life, she probably moves some things around and, you know, has composite characters and a bunch of things that people telling stories have to do to make it more logical or more compelling. And I think that this movie, especially when you watch her watching the publishers put her book together at the end, you get that this movie is sort of a love letter about this, the original book, but it's also sort of Joe's love of her creative work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just watching her seeing it published and, you know, the joy she takes and watching every step of the process, in that we are kind of led into that. We watch, you know, the typesetting and the pages being printed and being bound and all these things. Yeah, I think that that is sort of a function of the time shifting, as you were saying, too, is that in her composition of the book, she would have to sort of relive these things and reorder them and look back at them and edit them in a way that's not strictly from A to Z. And yeah, I've just seen Gerwig talk about that this, like her, Joe's love of the work is the central love story, and that the romance to Frederick is, you know, secondary. And I think that those scenes of watching her enjoy that, and as you said, just the nonlinear nature reflecting her work for this art, I think speaks to that as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something we've touched on, but I guess haven't really elucidated like clearly, is the thing that I like the most about the presentation of her as a creative person is that she's a creative person that we watch grow. She's not like some I'm a creative genius and I've come into this world and my first idea is always the best idea. And yeah, like we've run through all the discussions that she has where she's learning, you know, who she is, what her voice is and what she should write about. And I think for somebody who's as passionate as Joe is, and as a representation of a creative person who is just famous, you know, like just a very famous literary figure, I think it's cool to see her depicted as somebody who wasn't always, like, she had to grow into the person that could write Little Women, as opposed to being born the person that would write Little Women. Yeah.
Exactly. No, that's what I like about or Frederick's criticism.
Exactly. That's an experience that every creative person goes through, but for whatever reason, almost no art about creative people depicts that growth. They tend to be seen as just like geniuses, you know?
Yeah.
They were born this way and that's just how it goes. Which is just not, I don't believe that to be the case at all. Okay, where to now? I'm going through all of my notes. It throws me off with the time shift, and just throws me off so much.
Yeah, you mentioned Aaron Sorkin. Is there any other sort of inspiration you see in this? Is there any other directors or any other movies that you find popping up for you?
I guess the only movie that really jumped to my head for things that like a movie that this movie really reminded me of, and it's only in little pieces, is Barry Lyndon, the Stanley Kubrick movie from 1976, yeah. I think. And that movie is, Little Women is better than that movie, but like there's the thing that movie is famous for is being a very static movie. And it's basically like every shot is basically designed like a painting, you know? And it's just like, we're looking into this world that the idea is like you're in an art gallery and you can see the story behind every painting, right? There's a lot of like slow zooms in that movie, just on Ryan O'Neill standing still in a courtyard, you know? And I found that parts of this movie to be really reminiscent of that, because like I said, the idea of Barry Lyndon is sort of showing the story behind the still frames that we've been able to see, simply because filmmaking as a technology didn't exist, so he couldn't see these stories in motion at the time. And this movie visually, like, with doesn't have like a lot of wide grand shots, but when it does, they're very painterly, right? And the one that's coming to mind is when Fred, I forget his last name, Fred Vaughn, proposes to Amy, and we sort of see it in this just incredible wide shot. They're perfectly center framed, and he gets down on one knee, right? And the painting is him down on one knee holding her hand, and then she pulls her hand away, right? You know, like, you don't see the sadness that comes next. You just see that beautiful image, if you're in an art gallery, of these two people together. It's like united by love. And now we see this hand get pulled away. And the reality is that Amy didn't want to marry you. And
yeah.
I think pretty much every time we get a big wide shot like that, the idea is to show us this is gorgeous, but there's like an underlying sadness to it. And it feels like every time they do a shot like that, it's something sad has happened. Like, a pretty obvious one is the wide shot of Beth's funeral. Like, when we're introduced to that scene, you know, the bottom right corner is the actual funeral. And then it's just this wide shot of trees and the sun is out, but it's like tucked right behind a tree. And it's just this gorgeous image, but of course the underlying sadness is obviously Beth's death, you know? And right.
Yeah.
When Laurie, the other one that I really remember is Laurie and Joe have their fight in that field. And then Joe is left by herself and she sits down in the field and she's perfectly in line with this church that's in the distance. And incredible marketing by Saoirse Ronan on that. And it's just this gorgeous shot, but she's just so emotionally demolished. And and I guess the last one that I remember is the Beth and Joe on the beach. This is when Beth is talking about how she's accepting her death, and we see the sand blowing out towards the water after she's talked about the tides coming in. You just can't really stop it. Like, I'm gonna die. It's just about when. Those are all just like singular beautiful shots, and the idea is that every one of them is just built on this, like, this layer of just deep sadness, you know. And it's just these gorgeous historical, the idea being these gorgeous historical things are built on more sadness than we can really see at a single moment. You know, you have to see the whole story to sort of help recontextualize it.
Yeah, and I think that is part of what maybe appeals to both of us about this being sort of less Oscar baity. Like, it is a beautiful movie in a lot of ways, but it just doesn't feel like it gets bogged down in big vistas or big meaningless shots that are just showing the scale and the scope of what's going on.
Yeah. No, like, find me a gorgeous shot in this movie that doesn't have like film grammar meaning in it. You know, like, it just doesn't exist. Yeah. It does not exist.
Yeah, and it's not a war epic, so you're not going to get those big shots of something like that. I understand that this is a story that's kind of smaller than a lot of what we would consider traditional Oscar bait, but it seems to be a movie that's so much more interested in interiority and smaller ideas and these relationships between these sisters and, you know, some of the men in their life. But it really feels like it's you know, telling these more small personal stories and then uses those sort of bigger, grander images to still convey something, as you said, with film grammar, and typically something sad and something not just like, look, we got this whole set and we have a lot of money. Look how big this is. It's so grand. It really saves its grandiosity for its emotional storytelling.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And I think a big... I mean, we haven't really talked about the performances in this movie, but I one of the most important aspects of making this movie work is simply having people that you want to spend all of this time with and, like, telling the story, right? Like, Saoirse Ronan needs... she can't, like, if the person playing Joe isn't somebody you want to look at or watch perform for as long as the she's on screen in this movie, like, this movie falls flat on its face, you know? And... Yeah. Saoirse Ronan's great in this movie. Florence Pugh is even better, you know, like, as Amy. I think she's incredible, and she's the one giving, like, I think the most It's a more over the top performance, but I think the most engaging performance, and I think the number of times I laugh in this movie is more. She's more responsible for most of them than I think anybody else, and I think she's great. And but in general, like every performer you in this movie, you have to want to sort of watch them just sort of like sit on a chair and maybe not do anything in a scene, but they just have to be watchable. You know, like Laura Dern in a smaller role. I thought Eliza Scanlon, who is an actor I had never heard of before, as Beth was incredible. Emma Watson, who I normally just have no interest in, didn't annoy me at all, which is a great success. Weirdly, when Bob Odenkirk shows up, it's the worst part of the movie. Like I just don't understand this movie at all. And of course, Tracy Letts is Mr. Dashwood. I think that's an like you have to nail that casting too to make the movie work. But I just think that everybody in this movie is just so good, and all of the things that we've talked about to this point that are creative about the movie work because the performances do. You know, like if any one of those performances takes you out of the movie for longer than Bob Odenkirk's appearance, then the whole movie falls on his face, and it's incredible. Chris Cooper's in this for three scenes, you know, like and I haven't even mentioned Meryl Streep, you know, like it's the idea, the foundation was great, but without the right collection of actors to tell the story, I don't think this movie would have worked as well as it does. And I know, like over the years, I do not give enough credit to actors, and I have tried to fix that in more recent years. And this is a perfect example of when we need to give the actors their due, you know?
Yeah, and they did a Greta Gerwig did the Anatomy of a Scene. Did you
Oh,
watch
okay.
that?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so
I
it's
just
when
watched this movie over and over again. I didn't really do much else.
that's fine.
Yeah.
It's when Laurie bring Laurie's I think first. Oh yeah, it's his first time in their home, and he's pretty quiet in that scene. You know, he doesn't do a lot of talking. He's kind of just watching the sisters and Marmee interact and deal with the ankle injury and all that. And Greta Gerwig said that, you know, she watched a lot of Altman films to try to get
Oh, yeah,
this
that makes sense.
particular scene down, just because it's a lot of people talking at the same time, and they had to really kind of highly choreograph when people speak, so you still get the sense that there's a lot of fun and, you know, playful sisterly chaos, but still try to make some sense of what people are saying and what's going on. And that came to mind because it's just a scene where you have to watch these people kind of exist as they are, and they're not really interacting with Laurie. They're not really interacting with the viewer in the sense that they're intentionally conveying information for to us, or, you know, very straightforward moving the plot along. You know, it's just a scene where you have to watch these people just be who they are and like it. And I don't say have to in the sense that they're not giving you something to like, but just to your point of these have to be performers that you enjoy watching, and this scene isn't really kind of about you. It's not about Laurie. It's not about the new person in the home. It's about this home and how it always functions, whether someone's there or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you're being invited into this home, or Laurie is being invited into this home, and but this is how the home operates, even when there's a guest. You know?
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, for sure. And just I don't know. Every scene in this movie has a great actor in it, and it's wonderful. Do we talk? Well, let's talk about the past. You know, I think we're kind of there. Just the I so the first time I saw this movie, and I say this as something like that I think eventually helped my understanding of the movie, is that there was a very loud popcorn eater right behind me, and that like mouth open popcorn chewing sort of situation. And she's a pretty old woman, so I'm not gonna like turn around and tell her to be quiet. So like about 10 minutes into this movie, I just got up and moved away from her. And I think in that moment is when the 7 years earlier piece of text comes up on screen. So I did not see that the first time I saw this movie. And I think I kind of would have come to this conclusion anyway, but I think it really it makes because the time shifting is pretty clear. Like you don't need to be told it's 7 years early for, I mean, I suppose for movie viewers like us, maybe for others, you kind of want that. But Just the orange sort of like warmth of the images from the past sort of make it clear that we're in the past, and just the way that every character is talking in a different way. Like you said, that sort of like Altman over talking or overlapping lines, and the staging, like I said, is all of it reminded me sort of a Sorkin sort of thing, which is basically a stage play because everybody has to talk at exactly the right time to make the dialogue flow properly. And it just sort of immediately felt like a dream, you know? And I think the second time we go into the past is that first Christmas morning that just, it just feels like somebody remembering a Christmas morning as opposed to somebody experiencing it, or sorry, remembering a Christmas morning from their past, like this warm, this really warm memory that they have and something that they keep to sort of comfort them when they're alone on a train going to see their sick sister, you know? And I think everything about the past sequences is, it's just, I mean, the color scheme is warmer. It's an orange color scheme as opposed to the blue in the present. The cold sort of blue that and always seems to be overcast in the present, and it's always sunny in the past.
Yeah.
And all of these things. And it just sort of made me, pretty early on, I was like, oh, is this a movie about Jo reflecting on her past and then writing her story, which it ends up being. But as soon as I had that thought, I was like, no, there's no way this movie will do that. And I think that's sort of what makes the movie so impactful by the end of it, is that you can kind of see what it's doing, but you also doubt it. Like, you just don't think it would have, a movie would have the confidence to do that. And then it absolutely does. And it nails everything. It sticks the landing. And I think that's sort of another thing about this movie that's so impressive, is that it feels like everything Jo is reflecting on from the past is a dream. But it's not done in a way that's obvious to the audience. Like, you, I don't think my interpretation is necessarily the one that Greta Gerwig has, you know? And,
right.
But I think, so I think the idea that it's reality that she's seeing in the past, like these are clear memories, or, sort of having this dreamlike, view of the past, I think either of those interpretations works. And I don't think the movie's any less powerful, whichever side you believe. And, I don't know. I just thought it was, just those, the idea of somebody navigating their own past and who is also a storyteller. I just think it lends itself to some sort of exaggeration to make the memories more, more beautiful, more alive, I guess.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense.
And also, like, Jo throughout the movie talks about things in a way that I think both times she's talking to Meg, I think she's talking about Laurie the first time when the Meg's, or maybe this one's Marmee, I forget, but says, "Do you miss him?" And Joe's response is, "I miss everything." And I mean, that's so sad. But and then towards the end, I think this is on Meg's wedding day. No, this has to be after Beth has died. I can't believe childhood is over. And Meg says it was going to end one way or another. And Jo, this is very subtle throughout the movie. She seems to be somebody who really is trying to hold on to the past. And I mean, the last shot of this movie is her physically holding on to a representation of her past, you know, but like, yeah. But she does seem like somebody who almost romanticizes the things in her past that she loved. And I think it's the way that the past story is told is so romanticized visually, and just the energy of it that, that I think that that theory holds water.
Yeah. And just that it's her, I mean, this movie plays with the idea of different people's values. I mean, so much about, the way that the four sisters, the Little Women, grow up and, choose to live their life, and how or if they choose their partners speaks to that as well, and that everybody's view of the world is different. And what you're getting at about her romanticizing the past, like even her life that she has shared with these people so intimately and so closely, she has a different idea of what that is and what it meant and how it's going to be remembered. And I think it's Meg who says, just because it's someone else's dreams doesn't mean they're less valuable or something like that. And yeah, I think it just speaks to the way that people hold on to different things and the way people view different things, and that each person's life, even for sisters seemingly as close as these people, their lives are their own. Their individual lives and their perceptions and their memories of it all are still, and the future and their goals and ambitions are so deeply personal that even a close family like this has different experiences about the same experiences.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And just to further drive home my "this is a dream" reflection idea, I remembered the Bob Odenkirk introduction to this movie. Like that Christmas morning, it's like every single character in the movie congregates together, and then they're all like hanging out, and Amy's being like, "Oh, you're wasting the popcorn on the decorations that we can't even see," all these things, and then in walks Dad for the first time in the movie, brought by the person that Meg will end up marrying. Like it's just like that didn't happen. There's no way. You know? And I think that's why part of the reason why I know I keep harping on this, why Bob Odenkirk's introduction to this movie just feels so jarring. And he immediately says the title of the movie, which really adds to it. But it's like, I think it's so jarring the first time you see it, because maybe you haven't come to the conclusion that the Under the Umbrella chapter will get to you, where it's like, not all of this is real. It's like, this scene feels like bullshit because you haven't accepted that some of the other scenes are also like emotional bullshit, you know? Like, and like anything that annoys you the first time you see a movie, when you watch it the second time, it doesn't annoy you. But the I thought that was sort of the arc I went on with Bob Odenkirk's appearance. You know, it's like,
yeah,
my initial reaction is, oh, we're getting too cute too late in the movie. And then eventually it's like, oh, no, that works. I get that.
Yeah, stepping stone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think we have to talk about, I think now's a good point to jump to Amy and Florence Pugh specifically, because I loved her performance in this movie top to bottom. I mean, it's hard to rank who has the most difficult performance between her or Saoirse Ronan, because Saoirse Ronan has to carry pretty much every scene in the movie. But I think, well, I guess with the exception of the scenes that Amy has to carry, but she's sort of giving these parallel performances in the past and the present. And I think the way that she does it isn't very over the top. It is over the top when she's playing it for humor, for sure. And she's incredibly funny. But the way that she plays Amy in the past is like how, if you had a weird relationship with your younger sister, or like a relationship where you had like fought each other, you know, a lot growing up, that you would remember her as Florence Pugh is playing Amy, you know, just this, like, you know, like you can get along here and there, but you are just like, those things that she did that annoy you really nag you. And also, like, you can never really 100% get over the burning a handwritten story that there's no second copy of. Like, that's cold as ice. And, like, and I think the way that she plays her in the past is so cool. And then, or so, like, exaggerated. And then we get to the present, and she's just giving a, like, full stop great performance as a human being of Amy, once Amy starts living her own story. Because the things that she's experiencing in Europe are totally apart from Joe, right? Like, Joe has no memory of these things. These are happening outside of Joe. And the connection is that her relationship with Laurie and her relationship with Amy, but like the story itself that's taking place in Europe has no real connection to Joe other than that. And so she gets to play Amy like a real human being, and she's just does an incredible job when the marriage is an economic proposition conversation. Like, that's her big, like, that was probably the clip that they would have played if they still played clips for Best Supporting Actress montages, you know? And but even like all throughout other scenes, she's just so, there's like a calm to her, like a real adult calm that she seems to have grown into, or maybe always had and Joe just ignored. And I just think that the line that she is towing in individual scenes is just so incredible. And I think the fact that once they start chasing after Frederick in the end, the Under the Umbrella, like, we have to get to the train station, she snaps into the young girl Amy, and you can still see that in little pieces in Europe as well. Like when she first sees Laurie at the beginning of the movie, she does the same thing. She's like, "It's Laurie," you know, like she's just and it's just such a great performance.
"Joe, I need to fix you" on the way to go see Frederick. Mm-hmm. Seemed like a very young Amy kind of thing to do.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard to even put together a top five funniest Amy moments in this movie, but in the carriage when Joe gets out to go chase after Frederick, the like scream that she does is so funny, and it comes after we know that the scene is like definitely fabricated to sell the story, and it's just, oh man, Florence Pugh should have won the Oscar. You know, I love Laura Dern, but give it to Florence.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think it's important to remember that she's the little sister. Mm-hmm. But in a way is also very composed and self-assured. And obviously there's difference between the way that she and Joe view the world and choose to function in it. And mm-hmm. so, as you said, every time we're dealing with younger Amy, we're dealing with Joe's version of younger Amy. Mm-hmm. And that shades everything, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard not to look at her as sort of a bit more annoying because we're seeing it all through this lens. But I think it's important because Amy's she's the only of the sisters that goes by her full name, you know, doesn't have sort of a cutesy diminutive version of it. And I think in a way she's always kind of seen herself as an adult. Mm-hmm. And we always just sort of get nudged off who she probably really is because we're hearing it through Joe's version of the story. Mm-hmm. And yes, she does some bad, like her destroying that book, as you said, that's so hard to get by.
Yeah.
Even as a viewer, like it's just, it's so cold because
I don't know that I would talk to my sister now if she did that to something I wrote 20 years ago, you know? I'm not Louise May.
Yeah.
You know?
And yeah, the notion that it's only to hurt her, you know, she didn't take something from her because she wanted it. Mm-hmm. She wanted Joe just not to have it, which is so cold. But yeah, I think that we see we have to deal with those ideas of Joe's representation of Amy and who Amy truly is. And you know, as you said, the stuff in Europe where we're getting sort of an unfiltered version of who she is. She's different than Joe, absolutely, but she seems very bright and very confident and very self-possessed and aware of what she wants out of the world. And you know, you can take Joe's side on her being maybe wrong about that sort of thing, but we have to see her as a whole person who lived their own life and had their own decisions. And I think that we get the bratty little sister vibe because of our, you know, our protagonist or narrator maybe, but we just always have to keep in mind that that's a lens we're being, that's being put between us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that is an interesting way that the movie contrasts Joe and Amy is that we've talked a lot about how Joe, it feels like Joe is remembering, you know, her past and sort of this fuzzy, like warmed by her memory sort of way. Amy, when we are introduced to her, she's painting, right? She's painting next to other people who are in her classes or whatever. And she's doing this very, like, they're painting people that are, like, lying on the grass, you know? And she's doing this very realistic style of painting, right? And she looks over to the person next to her who's doing this sort of, look, I don't know art words, but a slightly more abstract version. Like, it doesn't look as realistic as the way that Amy has approached it. And
impressionistic.
And there you go. Art words. And and Amy's like, you know, you can see it registering on her face. She kind of registers some sort of disappointment in her own work. And it's almost like she's somebody who sees the world for what it is and just this very, like, I don't know. It's hard to even put into words, but she sees the world for how it is, whereas Joe is willing to sort of make the world into her own thing. And I think that's a key distinction between the way that the movie shows us Amy's character in the present and also Joe in general. You know, Amy sees the world through the way it is and like wants to find her place in it, whereas Joe sort of fits the world, makes the world to fit her, kind of.
Yeah, and I think that when she has those speeches about how practical she is and about marriage as an economic transaction, and that she is very practical and straightforward, that's the time when the movie says the most important things about the period that it's actually set. You know, we kind of get some things, some optimistic messages from Joe and how she functions, but when the movie's actually very straightforward about what it's saying about that time in history for women, it's Amy. It's the very practical person who is sort of cold enough to examine the realistic struggles for people around that time. Not that Joe never does, but for it to be put so explicitly, you need a character that is sort of colder the way that Amy is, and not as fanciful as Joe is, and not that that makes her a bad person or a bad character, but when you need you need that sort of gritty person to really be upfront about the nature of reality at certain times.
Yeah, absolutely. And Laurie certainly needed it at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. We don't talk much about Laurie.
No, I mean, yeah.
You just don't want to talk about Timothy Chalamet.
Well, okay. So to the listener, I'm not a big Timothy Chalamet fan. I will say that he's pretty good in this movie, and it's just sort of like the fight scene with Joe is when it just sort of comes off as a, like, he's just not good enough in that scene. But I mean, you're standing next to Saoirse Ronan. There's always so much you can do. So yeah, that's sort of my, and I guess I just find Laurie to be the least interesting character in this movie of the, you know, main collection of people. Because his arc is dictated by the other people, basically. And eventually, I don't know, he's just a boring rich kid, basically, is kind of where I'm at with him. And I'd just rather talk about the sisters.
Yeah.
Kind of where I'm at with it. I know we talked about the color palette of this movie, but I feel like I would feel shitty if we didn't mention this and because there's a couple of moments in this movie where the orange and blue sort of visual styles kind of bleed into each other, and you know, where you see blue in the past or you see orange in the present, and this movie is a very, like, I don't know, the way it uses visual storytelling outside of the orange and blue, which I think pop pretty hard and are quite obvious, but some of the visual storytelling is very subtle, and this is something that I think illustrates that. Like when on that Christmas morning when the girls, when the Marches give their Christmas breakfast up for the poor family down the street, you know, that's the scene where I had talked about, you know, this is just so dreamlike, and then they walk into this other poor family's house and they open the door and you see into it and it's all blue. You know, like it's the, because there's no, it doesn't seem like there's a fire burning in their house even. And as they start unpacking the breakfast, you then get another shot of the family where it's a similar frame to what we saw as they walked in. And I'm picturing, I think it's two children on a bed looking up at the door frame, just totally blue, that overcast sort of look that we get throughout the present. And then breakfast gets unpacked. We get another shot and the mom of that family is in it. And it's just warmer. It is just suddenly warmer. And it's like the Marches have brought some sort of warmth into this house. And that I enjoyed that. That's something I noticed on the fourth viewing, you know, and I think that's something that really underscores just how well crafted this movie is. And we had talked about the shot at Beth's funeral when Joe is looking down at her grave and everybody else leaves the frame, and we still have the shot of Joe and she's staring at Beth's grave, and we're going to find out she's thinking about Beth. And after everybody clears out of the frame, it's a sunny day, but they're in the shade, and things just, the color of it just starts to warm up. And I don't know how they did it. I don't know if they did it in color correction and post. I don't know if they had an additional light happening, but like watch that scene, like see the first frame of that shot and the last frame of that shot, they're totally different. And then it just warms up and then we jump into the past. And I thought that was such a really cool transition that, again, is very subtle. And if you're not specifically looking for it, you're just not going to see it. And I loved it. I thought it was great. Again, of these things jump out on the fourth viewing. Yeah, that's kind of movie.
Yeah, just the idea of the orange representing kind of this warmer thing in the past, and the blue being sort of the cold present for the most part. Mm-hmm. When the family goes to visit the Hummels and give them their, you know, their Christmas breakfasts, you get the sense that that would have just been a memory that the Hummels before the Marches show up, that this Christmas would have been one that they don't think about, or when they think about it, it is that cold. There's no sort of warmth to it, and the what the Marches provide is this chance that in the future they could look back on this and it have some of that warm glow that we're talking about, some of that, the way that you look about that path with nostalgia and those really positive feelings. And it's only their actions that, you know, imbue the Hummel family with that ability to look back on this Christmas as a good family, pleasant memory. And that's the role that they play for another family.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk just a little bit about performance, because this is something that I'm curious. I don't really have a take on. I'm just curious to ask you this question. Like, what do you think this movie says anything about performance, both like artistically and socially?
Yeah, I think that the girls are, the Little Women are hyper aware of their role that they have to play. You know, that when you know, they go to the different dances and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and Laurie will say to someone, you're not actually going to marry one of these people. And it's this little sort of dream where they get to, she sort of just plays a part at that dance without really fully embracing it. And I think that she is aware that this is not who she is, but she's sort of filling the space of someone who is there.
Sorry, are you talking about Joe or...
No, Meg.
Meg, okay.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. No. Meg's role at that dance and that, you know, and then we have Joe sort of backstage where she can be herself. And I think that one of my favorite parts of this movie is when Joe and Laurie are kind of dancing in the hallway and on the veranda, and they're living this sort of parallel life to the people inside. And they're still doing largely the same thing. You know, they're dancing. They're dancing to the same music in almost the same spot. But that representation, I mean, that scene, I think, altogether does most of the things that I like about this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still contemporary. You know, they're not doing dance moves that hadn't existed at that point. But it's played so much more modern. It feels contemporary to that, but again, modern. It doesn't feel anachronistic, but it still feels lively. It doesn't get sort of bogged down in the prim and proper and the quaintness of period pieces, but doesn't, you know, it's not the Converse shoes in Marie Antoinette's closet, to use an example that might not track with anybody else.
That tracked with Angela for sure.
Okay, good. Yeah. I think that that's, you see their genuine joy. I think that we haven't talked about it, but the Joe Laurie relationship is so central to this. And the way that those two are sort of quickly in sync with each other, they have sort of unisex names or names that go to the other gender more often. And it just feels like this really good, perversion might be the wrong word because there's nothing bad about it, but mm-hmm. the way that they sort of flip everyone's expectations on their head, or it's very non-performative at that part. They're not doing it to kind of stick it to the man. This is something that is just for them. And even you know, even when they pass the windows, they'll sometimes go into the more conservative dance the way that people are on the inside. And so they know that, you know, and just like some of the things we were talking about, this movie functioning as commerce and art at the same time, they know that they still have to play that role in public. There is still part of you that has to do A, B, and C, but in those moments in between, in those spaces, in those between the windows, you can still do X, Y, and Z, and those mm-hmm. are things that are important to you. You can still tell popular stories, but smuggle in your poetry. And I think that movie, that scene looks really good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got some of these bigger moments of camera movement and these big shots, and you know, obviously took a lot of choreographing and blocking and things like that. And I just think that that's a scene that we get so much of the good things about this movie, about performance, about art versus commerce, about two people kind of finding their own stride and their way to exist with each other, even if it doesn't line up with people's expectations of how you should act or the kind of person that you should be, or importantly, the kind of person that you should be with. We get the idea that Joe and Lori, despite probably having a wide range of very intense feelings for each other throughout their lifetime, aren't who people around them thought they would end up with. And this just seems like, to me, the best part of their relationship together, the part that we see of their relationship when things are sort of perfect. You know, they haven't bumped up into some of the bad realities that they're going to have to deal with and ultimately fail not to really reconcile with each other. But to me, that is, and it's not certain whether it's friendship or love at that point, but it just seems like two people who are very much in sync with each other and very much found a way for them to share the same space and absolutely love doing it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you talk about when they go in front of the windows, that's an element of performance. That's the social performance. That's when they're dancing for everybody that's at the party in case they're looking out the window. And I think the social performance aspect of the movie is most clearly demonstrated through Meg's arc, which is a pretty minimal part of this movie, but it's basically all Meg has to do individually. You know, we're introduced to her buying that fabric for the dress, spending $50 she doesn't have on something that's just fabric. It's not even anything functional. It has to be sent away to be turned into something functional, right? And she does that because she feels pressured by her friend, who we see two other times in the movie, both of which Meg feels socially pressured into doing things. And I think her whole arc is the idea of her coming to terms with the fact that this is who she feels like she's supposed to be, maybe it's who she wants to be, but it's who she feels like she's supposed to be. And it's only towards the end when she has her conversation with John, and she's like, I'm happy being your wife, I'm happy with our family and all these things, we don't need the fancy dresses. And she sells the fabric back to that same friend that she had purchased it with. You know, it's like she's sort of like, here, you can have that world, you know, like I've got mine.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of the social performance aspect of that movie. And just the idea of Meg standing on that staircase and just being stared at with all those other girls and in their fancy pink dresses and all those things. And that being intercut with Beth playing music by herself. And I think it's just an interesting combination of moments. You know, I mean, Mr. Lawrence sits at the bottom of the stairs and listens, but Beth doesn't know about that. Or if she does know, we're not told about it. And I think the idea of doing something when nobody's watching and still loving it, like Beth is very vocal about her piano playing. She says specifically, I only do that for us. I don't need anybody else to hear it. It's the idea of finding joy in creating art that nobody's going to experience outside of a very small group of people. And you just sort of, the only way you're going to make something that's like artistically successful is if you don't pander to the audience, basically, or care about the audience, you know, which in fairness is very in line with how I think about mainstream art in general. But yeah, I just thought that was an interesting thing that's running throughout the movie. And the girls put on plays for family, and all these, oh god, they're so good. And I don't know, I just thought there was an interesting idea of performance running throughout that's not really focused on too much but is always there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way that it is focused on, I guess, is when with Joe's individualism. And one of the things I like the most about this movie and the most about Joe is that she's a contrarian, right? She doesn't want to be told what to do. And as soon as somebody tells her to do something, her immediate reaction seems to be not to do that or to want to do the opposite. And I think the way that the movie, it doesn't do it a lot, but the way that the movie negotiates Joe eventually almost feeling pressured to do something specifically because she's the type of person that doesn't do everything or doesn't do the things that other people want to do. And I think the things that really drive this home is when she talks about, I think this is with Marmee right before she starts writing the book, after Beth has died, like she doesn't know that she loves Lori, but she knows that she wants to be loved and feel loved. And I think her navigating that the idea is that love for her doesn't necessarily have to be like traditional marriage. And I think the conclusion she comes to is that it's not, you know, and it's a different version of love. It's just finding a way to keep her family around her as opposed to like somebody like Lori or Frederick. And I think most of her back and forth when she writes that letter to Lori that never ends up being read by him at the end, I feel like that's sort of out of confusion because that's what she feels like she's supposed to do. And like what we said with Joe writing her stories that Dashwood asks for, the saucy stories, quote unquote, like that's, she's writing that way because she feels like that's how she's supposed to write. And I think that's cool. And the other moment that this is a more comedic moment where Joe's sort of like being a normal person really shines through is when she's crying after she's cut her hair, which is so, so funny. And so like, that's such a normal human thing to do. She's like, she's Joe first. And then later that night, she sort of like realizes what she's done. And she goes back to being like everybody else and crying over a bad haircut. And
it's her only beauty.
Amy. God damn it. And I just thought, I think again, something that runs throughout this movie, but is never hit too hard is just the idea of Joe dealing with the idea of being a contrarian, but a contrarian who's also a human, you know, and
yep.
So that can be a hard thing to negotiate sometimes. And, this movie's her doing that, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And one quick thing I do feel obligated to mention, this isn't natural, but the letters and voiceovers is I think we see five letters read in total throughout the movie, three of which have these sort of cutaway shots of the writer speaking directly into camera. I'm thinking of Frederick when he leaves, the Shakespeare books for Joe, later when Joe writes to Mr. Dashwood, with the first few chapters of Little Women, and then when Mr. Dashwood rejects the chapters of Little Women. And those three letters are written for an audience of one. They're specifically addressed to one person, and they're read by one person. And when we see those letters being read, we hear the writer's voice and we see the person reading it, and then we get a cutaway to the writer staring directly in the camera. And I thought that was an interesting representation of writing something for an audience of one. I thought that was cool, and it jumps out in the style of the movie. And you contrast that to when a letter is written to the girls, like the Christmas Day letter. We hear Laura Dern's voice reading it, not Bob Odenkirk's, and we don't get that cutaway of Bob Odenkirk because this is a letter that has been given to the group to do what they will with. And that's sort of more representative of something like classic fiction, where once it's for a lot of people, then people can do what they want with it. You know, you can you hear a different voice reading it. You hear Laura Dern as opposed to the writer. You hear Greta Gerwig as opposed to Louise Alcott. And I just thought that was a cool small thing. And that's one of the more obvious like filmmaking things that they do. Like, they're breaking the fourth wall, you know, and yeah. They're very upfront about that. And I just I thought it. I don't know. I would have felt guilty if we didn't mention it. Yeah.
No, I think it absolutely bears mentioning. And I think it is. I think it's good in that sense of what you mentioned about it being when it's one-to-one communication, you kind of understand the way it's being communicated, and you do feel a direct address. And when you compare it to something for a group of people, even when it's a group like a family, even when it's four people and a mother or something like that, that when it's to a group like that, you can't picture it as perfectly. You can't hear the nuances that they would communicate with using with just you. And yeah, I think it's perfectly representative of this because it does everything that I was saying that I like about this movie. It doesn't do anything anachronistic. You know, it's not impossible for this idea of direct communication through a letter like that, but it's looking right at the camera. You know, it's some fourth wall breaking, it's some kind of modern film technique, but it does still fit in with the time period. And I think when you're making a movie that is about the obvious things that Little Women's about, but also about some of those themes that you pulled out about, you know, art and commerce and performance and what an artist like Joe or like Greta Gerwig is able to sort of put into something for public consumption. I think it hits a lot of the more interesting things perfectly.
Yeah, for sure. And I just want to talk about the opening and closing a little bit. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No.
Okay. So we see like the first shot of this movie after the quote that's the epigraph is, as we discussed, we see the back of Saoirse Ronan as Jo, like sort of gathering her courage to go into this publishing office. And she's just standing right in front of the door. And it's really interesting to see how that office is framed once she walks in, and also the first edit in the movie where we hear the sound of the door opening before we actually see her physically walking in. And it's just like, it's a split second of difference. And it's just like, I don't know that slip edit is the right term. If it was an interview being edited, I would call it a slip edit, but I don't think it is in this case, but it's something like that. And it's just like those jump cuts where we see Dashwood flipping the pages shortly after. It's something that's just a little bit off, and just but off in a way that is meant to represent that she's not necessarily ready to go through that door when it opens, but she has to. And like, that's her building up her own confidence. And I thought that was a really cool moment for somebody who is as confident as Joe seems to be in different parts of this movie, to see her having a scene of her collecting herself. And we did all the artist commerce thing, so we don't need to hit that again. But just the idea of that office is very cold. It's very, like, if everything in the present is blue, everything in that office is gray. You know, like, yeah. it's almost its own world. And you see Joe walking through that office. I couldn't spot a woman in that office. And everybody in that office is man. And with the exception of Dashwood, like, everybody's doing their own thing. At most, there's two people talking to each other, and you know, there's desks all apart from each other. There's nothing familial about it, right? She's just walking to this office where everybody's sort of separated, and again, it's just very dark. And then we get all the things we've talked about. And I do love that the title of this movie shows up. It doesn't really make sense in the story, but just that we see that red book that says Little Women, and that's her title card, and it says Louise May Alcott or L.M. Alcott as the name of the writer. I thought that was a touch that I can't really put into words, but that I think is quite nice. And because at the end we get the closing, and you talked about Joe watching her book be printed, and that sequence is just very enjoyable to watch in general. But we're seeing that intercut with the family party. It looks like it's Marmy's birthday that's happening at the Aunt March residence that has now seems to belong to Joe, right?
Plumfield.
Plumfield? Is that the name of the house?
Yeah, it's on the sign, and it's part of Alcott's real life.
But oh, okay. Shots are, I mean, it's sort of like beautiful, these beautiful Steadicam shots, you know, this sort of descending shot that we then walk into the house and see all these people running around, all the families together. It's shot very much like those sort of dream sequences that we've had, or dream/past sequences that we've had. And we see the cover of Little Women, and it's the same cover, but it now says Jo March on it. She's handed the book, and she just sort of stands there, holds it, and you know, she's been going to the it's been intercut with the scene with her family with Marmy, and then we jump further in the past than we've ever seen to this point. We see four girls hanging out, playing together, and they're having a tea party, and then they're holding swords in the air, not unlike they would when they performed together as teenagers. And it just shows that, like, even before the past that she's reflecting on to build this story, we see that that also had its own past that there's just no time for it. It's a 2-hour-and-15 yeah. minute movie. We can't fit all 700 pages of the book or whatever's in it. And And I just thought that's really beautiful. And then she's just holding that, like, jump back to the present. She's holding that book, and you know, she's holding, as I mentioned earlier, she's holding physical representation of her own history close to herself, right? And she looks down at it, and the fact that this is intercut with a scene that seems like it's kind of in the future, right? Like that it has either very recently happened or will happen shortly after this scene in the present, of Marmee's birthday. And it's almost like the past, we've seen those things sort of as dreams, and this is like the future dream to come for her. And she just looks at the past, and then she looks up and smiles, and it's the end of the movie because she's off to build the next dream. And I just, it's beautiful on so many levels. And this movie's fantastic. And yeah, and the contrast of the beginning and the ending just puts, for lack of a better term, an absolute perfect bookend on a movie that is just so tightly crafted in general.
I don't think I can sum it up better than
That's all I've ever wanted to hear you say. Thank you for thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Check back next time when we're talking about probably a movie that's slightly worse than Little Women, but still great.